fun. Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, your weekly little libertarian chat that comes into your earballs and eyeballs from the magazine of Free Minds and Free Markets. I'm Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Catherine Mangue Ward, and returning special guest star Jacob Everlovin Sullum. Welcome back, Jacob, and hello, everyone.
Howdy.
Thank you.
Hey.
Before we get started, I just wanted to thank everyone out there in Listenerville for all your generous contributions to our now completed Webathon annual fundraising thingy. We raised more than $600,000, which is 1.5 times the stated goal. And many of you said nice and constructive things about this very here podcast. So thank you all for that. Catherine, do you want to issue a robot beep of gratitude?
Beep boop. Thank you.
That's really good. All right. Let's go to the podcast section of our podcast. President Joseph Robinette Biden II's final days of office are being marked by extremely controversial applications, or trial ballooned applications even, of the chief executive's very important pardoning and commutation powers, beginning with the son Hunter, of course, but also potentially to any number of officials and bureaucrats who are deemed to be vulnerable to prosecution by the incoming Trump administration. Generating far fewer headlines last week was Biden's actual actions of pardoning 39 federal convicts and issuing around 1,500 commutations for people who had been serving out their federal sentences via home confinement. Jacob, you've been covering the pardoning power of presidents for a long time, and you've been critical of Biden. Can you put last week's numbers just kind of into context and characterize the group that was set free and the process by which it was done?
Yeah, so Biden is now close to Obama's total. In absolute terms, this is as of last week, 1,634 commutations granted, whereas Obama's total was 1,715. In percentage terms, though, Biden's ahead. It's like 14%. Now, he got fewer applications. So that's the main reason for that. But 14% is a higher approval rate than we've seen since LBJ. So
wow.
by comparison, Trump's was around 1%. Obama was, even though he had more in absolute terms, was only about 5%.
And this is, you say application. So like, I can apply to get Nick's convictions vacated via some kind of online form, or is there like a board that does it?
Yeah, these are petitions received by the Office of the Pardoned Attorney for commutations, meaning shortening of sentences, not pardons. And then the people who got commutations last week, this is about, as you mentioned, about 1,500 people who were on home confinement. And for the most part, it's hard to tell because they don't actually list the crimes for which they were convicted, which is a bit of an omission. Usually they will do that. But judging from the descriptions of people who received pardons, a lot of them were nonviolent drug offenders. A lot of them were described as people who had committed nonviolent crimes without the crimes specified. So that's a bit tricky because that doesn't mean there were no victims. And we know that in some cases, people who got commutations included people who definitely had victims. There were several government officials or politicians who committed massive fraud, and probably the worst one of all among the commutations was this judge from my hometown, Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, who had a scheme where he and another judge got millions of dollars in kickbacks for sending kids to privately run detention centers. And these judges, the judge who did the sentencing, was known for being very tough. And for years, people complained about this, mainly the relatives of these teenagers. And not many people took them seriously. They thought this was tough love. It was getting the kids on the straight and narrow. But it turned out that he was getting paid essentially for each kid he sent to detention, and one of whom committed suicide. So that was probably, now the guy who got the commutation, he's 72 now. He had at least a few more years to go on his sentence, even taking into account credit for you know, good behavior. So I don't see any reason why that guy's sentence should have been shortened. And there are several other examples of people who committed massive fraud, either stealing taxpayer money or bilking people, in many cases, people who were not very wealthy themselves and really got screwed over. So that's nonviolent. It's technically, all that is nonviolent, but it doesn't mean it's victimless. So I don't think we should conflate those two categories. You have about 64,000 people serving time in federal prison for drug offenses. Now, it doesn't mean that all of them are nonviolent, but a good portion of them are. You have about 3,000 people in there for growing marijuana or trafficking in marijuana. Those seem to be good candidates for further commutations, which I think we will see. I think Biden wants to get above Obama's total in the end.
He's trying to get that cherished Sullum endorsement here.
I don't know if he'll get an endorsement, but he's, look, it's better that he does it than not do it. It's a shame that presidents are always leaving this until the very end of their terms in office, because it means it's not done in as thoughtful a way as it might have been done. If it were done, if we were part of a regular process where they just do commutations and pardons throughout their terms, I think it would either be less cause for criticism, their rationale would be more understandable, and it wouldn't look like they're being sneaky on the way out the door trying to get something past people.
Catherine, there's in addition to the kind of important victimless versus nonviolent distinction that Jacob pointed out, and it seems like in this kind of large commutation, there wasn't necessarily a lot of thought given to that. I wanted you to grapple with something that kind of crossed my radar over the weekend and people talking about this, which is that there's some percentage, some number of people who plead out or are convicted of the offenses themselves are nonviolent or drug possession or something like that, but that's pled down from the actual crime that they did. And so by commuting sentences or pardoning these so-called victimless and nonviolent offenders, we're actually setting free some thugs out there in the world. What is your response to that line of criticism of using the pardoning power?
Yeah, it seems like maybe our system of charging people with a whole bunch of garbage and then letting them plead down makes it hard to know what people might have actually been guilty of. That just seems like it might be a bad system. That's where I am at. Like, yes, of course, as Jacob notes, if you do it all in a rush at the end, you're going to get some some bad apples in with the bunch, although I guess they're sort of all, it's a whole barrel of rotten apples. I'm not sure how that metaphor works.
But one bad apple don't spoil the whole bunch, I believe Michael Jackson taught us.
Yes.
Well, that's a person I would like to take moral lesson mm-hmm. from.
Who managed not to get charged, right? Or rather convicted. Excuse me.
Nick is taking the Peter Suderman role of extending the jokes. Go on, Catherine.
Yeah.
It's okay. I miss Peter, so it's fine.
Also are not really jokes, to be honest.
So what I am saying is it would be best if in our justice system we charged people with the thing that we thought they were guilty of and then tried to figure out if they were guilty of it. Can I highlight one person on the list? Jacob is quite right that the Kids for Cash judge is probably the most egregious. But I would like to point out Rita Crundwell, just
great
mostly
name.
Because she sounds like a Roald Dahl villain of some kind. which she was a former Dixon city comptroller who embezzled $53.7 million, including money used to buy quarter horses, which I don't know exactly what that is, but it's a fancy horse. Horses.
It's half of a half horse, okay.
Half of a half horse, okay. $2 million tour bus, jewels, furs, and multiple homes while the city struggled to pay for infrastructure.
Hashtag goals.
Rita Crundwell probably should have served the last 4 years of her 19-year and 7-month prison sentence.
I was going to add Jimmy DeMora, who is a former Cuyahoga County Commissioner in northeastern Ohio, who had been resentenced to 2022 to 23 years for a bunch of bribes as a you know, as a political, he got like $250,000 worth of bribes to, you know, feather the nests of his various friends and compatriots up there. And he was on home, you know, he was on home confinement. So, like, why not keep him there? What, you know, he's sick, et cetera. But, like, I don't know. That's the, you know, when you break the public trust, especially, like, you know, I mean, because we're not talking about, like, people selling nickel and dime bags of weed or something like that. We're talking about people who were either elected or held high office where they were dealing with public finances. And for me, the question with Biden, and this is true of a lot of the stuff that he does, especially, you know, as his, you know, he goes down the tubes before Trump takes over. The rhyme and reason just seemed to be completely missing to all of this. I mean, I think it's good that he's commuting or pardoning, you know, drug offenders. I think that makes sense. And I would love to see a coherent statement written by somebody around him to explain exactly why they're doing this. And not just that it's like, okay, I'm out the door and here's a final act of grace. But this is why we need to change the laws that I, Joe Biden, worked virtually all of my career to make. And intensify over the years. I think that would be a great legacy for a guy who really kind of has sucked as a president.
No, he didn't really, he didn't accomplish anything on the front end of any of this, right? So he campaigned on eliminating mandatory minimums. He campaigned on getting rid of the disparity between sentences for crack cocaine and powder cocaine, getting rid of the, you know, the death penalty. All this stuff, and he didn't do anything about any of that. Now, obviously, he can't do that on his own, but he didn't invest any political capital into achieving any of those things. It's better to not have people going to prison for ridiculously long periods of time to begin with, rather than having to come in after the fact and say, you know what, that was too long, or in light of your rehabilitation or whatever, as opposed to it's just too long. It was too long to begin with. You know, to my mind, any sentence at all for a nonviolent drug crime is too long, but Biden claims to think that the sentences that he supported throughout his career are too long, right? So it would be nice to have some actual statutory reform that prevents that from happening in the first place. Yeah.
He also didn't do anything about the people on federal death row. I mean, he effectively paused executions, but you know, that remains to be seen if he addresses that, because Trump is, you know, Trump is fond of the federal death penalty and is not afraid to use it. So if Biden is trying to make some kind of statement, you know, and, you know, that would be a place to look for before he leaves office.
I wonder.
Trump is fond of the death penalty for drug crimes as well.
That's right.
He wants to execute drug dealers, which seems, you know, somewhat inconsistent with his position that, you know, people are getting unfairly long sentences for drug trafficking. You know, he actually made a big deal out of that first time around when he ran against Biden. And then when he thought Biden was going to be his opponent this time around, he was kept attacking him from the left on drug policy. Even though, I mean, I don't think Trump really is sincere about that, except maybe in particular cases, there are people that he gave commutations to that he maybe felt bad for sincerely. But it's completely incoherent to say, on the one hand, it's wrong that people get a life sentence for a nonviolent, you know, first time nonviolent drug offense, but actually we should be executed. So that's Trump's position.
That is a shorter sentence in a way.
I'm sorry, Catherine, I didn't hear you.
That is a shorter sentence in a way.
Yes.
Yes.
Let's continue on the theme of Trumpian incoherence when it comes to things criminal justice. Last week, there were two bits of news that were associated with the January 6th, 2021 riots in the nation's capital on the day that the presidential election of 2020 was being certified. First was Trump again saying in interviews that he will likely be pardoning some of the January 6th convicts on the his first day in office, and also that some of the members of Congress's own January 6th select committee should go to jail for their work there. The second bit was the release of a long-delayed Justice Department Inspector General report about January 6th that found that there were 26 FBI informants at the Stop the Steal rally, 17 of whom got inside restricted Capitol grounds, and zero of which were prosecuted for any of that. The IG report also stated that none of them were actual FBI undercover agents, so they weren't on the payroll, and also that they did not play, according to the report, any kind of organizational role in the riots. Jacob, Congressman Thomas Massie, who for years has been pressing the Justice Department to cough up this information, he reacted to the IG report as follows, quote, "Today's shocking DOJ IG report provides Donald Trump with all he needs to pardon J6ers on day one. I urge him to do so." Is he right, do you think?
Well, no. First of all, these informants did not commit violent crimes. According to the report, most of them did enter either the restricted grounds or the Capitol itself, which is a misdemeanor, several misdemeanors potentially. So the fact that they weren't prosecuted at all, I think that's troubling. But you've got a whole bunch of defendants who were charged in connection with the Capitol riot who did commit violent crimes, who assaulted police officers, for example. So the fact that these guys didn't get prosecuted for wandering around in the Capitol, you know, does make it seem like the people who were prosecuted got a raw deal, if that's all they did. But it doesn't indicate that people who actually committed crimes of violence or vandalism or what have you, that they should be let off the hook or should be pardoned.
Nick, how do we feel about there being 26 law enforcement officers there? Just in general, kind of against the backdrop of, you know, so many different cases in which actual FBI employees have been involved with, you know, the plot to kidnap Governor Whitmer and other people.
That was so, I mean, it was so absurd. And I mean, the way that that case fell apart, because it was like, you know, it's always, on some level, it always seems like it's government agents trying to, you know, get the other government agent who's also undercover to commit the crime that then they can blame on a bunch of other people and arrest people like the four of us. But I'm mostly disturbed. I'm very disturbed by, first and foremost, the absolute breakdown of law enforcement, you know, doing its basic duty on that day. And that starts on a certain level with Trump being a dick through the whole thing, you know, and really leading to his second impeachment, I think, for, you know, understandable reasons. Like, you know, that makes sense. But the mayor of D.C. did not make the obvious adjustments to police and controlling the place. The FBI report actually talks a lot about how they did not actually check in with various kinds of local bureaus and things like that. The report chides the FBI, apart from the question of having paid informants, you know, milling around in the crowd. They did not share information. They did not issue the types of advisories and warnings that they should have done. At every level, this is like a series of government blunders that then let a bunch of stupid people commit crimes. You know, so on that level, it's disturbing. You know, I think you guys have kind of talked about the you know, it's not FBI agents. There were some people who went inside, et cetera. It's deeply troubling. And the FBI has long been, you know, an organization which is both incompetent and evil, you know, in various ways. And it needs a thorough cleaning out. It needs a thorough kind of rehabilitation and restoration to do something like it's supposed to be doing, but do it legally and do it smartly and competently and efficiently. And what I worry about is that, you know, as bad as it is, what we're looking at coming in is not going to, it's not going to change the dynamic. It's just going to allow for a kind of a weaponization against people that Trump dislikes. So that's what concerns me the most here.
Catherine, incoming Vice President J.D. Vance reacted to this by saying, "For those keeping score at home, this was labeled a dangerous conspiracy theory months ago." Is he right?
It depends on what you mean by this. You know, I think this is the issue here is immediately after January 6th, I think while it was still going on even, all of the possible theories emerged right away, right? Because it was such a remarkable event and everyone was looking. So was it Antifa who was doing this? And it was all, you remember that? There was like a whole big conversation about
that. Tucker Carlson had that theory among others.
I, for obvious reasons, am deeply sympathetic to the maybe it was the feds explanation. And I commend to you all C.J. Ciramella's October 2022 print article, It's Almost Always the Feds, in which he suggests at the very beginning of the piece, here's a tip. If you have some radical political views and an acquaintance reaches out, encouraging you to act on your convictions and maybe also offers to introduce you to a guy who can sell you some bomb parts, don't take him up on it. That guy is definitely, almost definitely working for the feds. This is good advice, probably for some of our listeners specifically. So, so I'm very sympathetic to the maybe it was the feds. I do not think what is in that IG report validates the idea that this was in some way an operation that was encouraged, coordinated, or planned by the FBI. And I think that that is an important distinction. Yes, there were a bunch of informers of probably varying degrees of reliability and officialdom and paid status lurking in that group. That is absolutely not the same thing as the FBI did January 6th. And I think that that's, you know, when we were talking about like, hey, maybe we shouldn't go out there and say this without any evidence, that was a reasonable position. So I don't think it gets us all the way there.
You know, in investigation and congressional investigations about this, Christopher Wray, you know, outgoing director of the FBI, danced around this too. Like he refused to flat out say there were no agents.
He kept saying there were no agents, and that does seem to have been true. But
that they weren't involved in the planning, et cetera. And this goes back to the, you know, I mean, the mega problem with a lot of this, you know, a lot of what's going on in a citizen's relationship to government is that, you know, people are, you know, they're lying or dissembling, and especially when you're talking in front of Congress and you're part of the government, you probably, it shouldn't have to be some kind of like arcane, you know, video game or something where you have to ask the question in exactly the right way to unlock the golden answers. You know, it's like, we're all fucking adults here. And it's like, if you want to be a Jesuit, you know, like fucking, you know, join the priesthood. But like, if you're talking in front of Congress, just, you know, a little plain speaking would be very appreciated in all of this.
I think I also,
I don't think the evidence shows that it was an FBI plot. I don't think it was a plot, in generally speaking, a plot at all. I mean, that's, if you look at all the evidence of what the charges ended up being, what did people actually do, you look at all the video, this was not planned in any kind of systematic way by anybody. Now, that contradicts, obviously, people who say it was an FBI plot with, you know, instigators and government-paid instigators, but it also contradicts the government's theory, the way, in particular, they pursued the cases against the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers, where they portrayed the riot as a thing we planned from the beginning that was basically executed by these groups, and that it was an insurrection with a particular aim in mind. And this, if you look at the evidence against those defendants, you know, at least half the time they had no idea what they were doing. This is these are the relatively organized people I'm talking about. Most of the people were not organized at all. But even among the people who were charged with sedition, there's a lot of dubious. There are a lot of dubious assumptions in those cases. And if you're talking about potential presidential clemency, I think there's a good argument that those guys got, you know, excessively severe sentences. That you had somebody like Stuart Rhodes, who definitely thought violence was an acceptable response to Trump's loss. I think that's clear. It's not clear that he ever intended to stop the certification of the electoral vote. In fact, the jury did not convict him of that. They acquitted him on that count of conspiring to obstruct the vote count. The guy, the head of the Proud Boys, was named Enrique Tarrio. Similarly, he wasn't even there. Not only didn't participate in the riot, he wasn't even on the grounds at the time. And it's not clear that he had a specific plan to disrupt that, ceremony. So in sentencing them, even on the judge can take into account conduct for which they were acquitted, which is a really troubling sort of practice. And basically, the government portrayed them as the people who caused the riot, which is absolutely not true. If they had not existed, this still would have happened. So they wanted to present this as an insurrection that was planned by particular organized groups, and I just don't think that's true. And the sentences they got reflected this idea that this was an insurrection that they caused, wouldn't have happened without them, not true, and that it wasn't a carefully thought out insurrection, which is not true either.
I also think this gets us back to what we were talking about at the very top of the podcast. I mean, Trump was asked about the 900 people who had pleaded guilty in connection with the attack, but weren't accused of any, assault of police officers or anything like that. And he rightly says they were probably pressured to take those guilty pleas. And he says, I know the system. The system is a very corrupt system. They say to a guy, you're going to go to jail for 2 years or for 30 years. These guys are looking. Their whole lives have been destroyed. For 2 years, they've been destroyed. But the system is a very nasty system. Not wrong. Like, where is the lie? But also,
these
are very nasty guys.
A really good illustration of that is what happened with this charge that they brought against about a quarter of the people charged in connection with the riot were charged with obstructing an official proceeding, meaning the congressional ratification of the election results. So that was the official proceeding. There's certain intent showings you have to show. It's just some guy who just wanders into the Capitol, maybe, didn't have the requisite intent, but they brought that charge against about a quarter of the defendants. And the Supreme Court said, you can't do that, basically, that under the law that has that provision, which is the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, it was aimed at financial fraud. And the Supreme Court said, unless you can show that this person was actually trying to prevent some kind of evidence from being available to an official proceeding, people cannot be guilty of this crime. Now what happens after that decision? Shockingly, probably not much of anything. Even though a bunch of people pleaded guilty to this, a bunch of people were convicted of this, what happens is that, the appeals have to make their way through the system. So some people might have that charge dismissed. But that doesn't mean their sentence will necessarily be changed because they have other charges that either were brought against them or in the case of people who pleaded guilty can now be. This is part of the plea deal. If that it specifically says if that charge is thrown out, and that's a felony punishable by up to 20 years in prison. If you get rid of that, we can bring other charges against you that we didn't bring before, right? So the upshot of all this is that probably very few people will see any sort of relief as a result of what seems like a pretty important Supreme Court decision that goes to the heart of the cases against a bunch of these guys. So that's pretty shocking, I think. And then, when if they are resentenced, the judge can still take into account conduct that they were not convicted of, right? So, I mean, they're screwed coming and going. So I'm sure, look, I don't know the details of every one of these cases. Obviously, there are a lot of cases. This is about 1,500 cases or so. But I'm sure that some people got screwed. I don't think Trump is going to bring the proper, care in distinguishing between the people who received appropriate punishments and the people who got screwed. But certainly people did get screwed.
Nick, as part of that, I think we can all kind of agree with the basic thrust of where Jacob's coming from on this. What happens if Trump comes into office and just does a blanket pardon for everybody except for like 10 people or 15 people? Like, you will definitely redress some of those injustices that Jacob points to. You will also get people off from conduct that was probably violent. There was a victim and it was bad, dude. What would that be for our sense of justice and where we are politically as a country and just in the cycle of violence, man?
Yeah, I think it will be bad if Trump comes in and does a complete pardon of everybody. And, there's a couple of people like the guy who is, from my reading, has been held the longest in a pretrial custody situation pretty much since shortly after January 6th, Jacob Lange, who is violent. He most recently asked for a delay in his trial because he hasn't been brought to trial yet because he's hoping for a pardon for Trump. This is a guy who should not be, you know, walking the streets. Like, he's a violent thug who has said, I did go there in order to overthrow the government. And if you think violence isn't, you know, a legitimate response to Joe Biden stealing the election, F you, you know, like, so I hope that Trump will bring a level of scrutiny, you know, that Jacob has laid out here. That would make sense. And that would also, I don't know if the public would appreciate that. I know that the anti-Trump people who are now talking about how if you say anything good about Donald Trump, you are pre-surrendering to the new fascist regime that is about to take place with Kid Rock, you know, leading the charge on the inauguration. But I would love to see that. And it would also signal to people, I think, something that, you know, in the interview he did a couple of weeks ago with Meet the Press, where he actually leaned off. He said he was not going to personally push for investigations, you know, of the usual gang of people who he claims need to be investigated. He said he would be hands off at Department of Justice and the FBI. And that's interesting. And it's different than when he came into office the first time and he pushed, you know, extremely hard for Hillary Clinton to be investigated. And Jeff Sessions said, I'm not going to do that. You know, his push to get Zelensky in Ukraine to investigate the Bidens is what led to the first impeachment. Like, Trump is actually sounding different this time, even if some of the people around him, notably Cash Patel, seem much more vociferous about going after people. But so if Trump comes in and does what Jacob suggests, you know, and actually lets out the people who deserve to be let out because they were pressured by what Catherine rightly called, you know, a bad system, or noted that he called a bad system, I think that would be fantastic. It would be an incredibly great way to start his second term, along with, of course, commuting the sentence of, if not pardoning, Ross Ulbricht.
But he's lying, right? Probably?
Almost certainly. Or yeah. He doesn't even know what he doesn't know what he's saying.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, a problem to which you kind of alluded is that the people that he's deferring to supposedly include Cash Patel, who has explicitly said, here's a list of 60 people that are part of the deep state conspiracy, meaning that they annoyed Trump in one way or another.
That they gave bad reviews to his children's book on Amazon.
They're guilty. They're guilty of crimes. I'm not going to tell you what the crimes are right now because we have to look into that and figure it out later. But they absolutely deserve to be prosecuted. And that's not an exhaustive list. He makes very clear, because that's just people who've served in the executive branch. There are also members of Congress. There are also, other various hangers-on, including people in the media who, you know, were part of this conspiracy. And, you know, Trump has said the members of the January 6th committee are guilty of treason. Look it up. It's really hard to figure out how they're guilty of treason. Did they adhere to the enemy in time of war? I don't think so, unless you define war in very vague terms. He's also argued that they destroyed evidence. He claimed they destroyed all the evidence they had collected, which is obviously not true, because you can look that stuff up online too. There's a really long, an 800-page report and lots of transcripts that you can have a look at. So I don't know what, you know, Trump doesn't really have anything in mind. I think it's fair to say he just throws out whatever he can think of. But then if Patel is confirmed as FBI director, it's actually going to investigate these people like Liz Cheney and every other member of that committee. What would even the theory be? I don't know. What's the theory by which they're guilty of a crime? So you can say, since it's bullshit, we shouldn't take it seriously. Don't worry about it. Except that the very process of being investigated, imposes a big burden on people. And has a chilling impact, even if no prosecutions result, or even if the prosecutions are ultimately unsuccessful, and it has been pointed out that the fact that Cash Patel has announced in advance the people that he thinks should be prosecuted, and without an investigation, without saying what the charges actually would be, that actually would help people make the case that they're victims of vindictive prosecution if they ever are actually charged, which is usually very hard to prove. But in this case, he's given them a lot of ammunition.
So then do you agree with the preemptive pardons that people are now saying? I mean, this is, to my mind, and I think we talked about this last week or the week before, you know, here is where we get into this, you know, weird cartoon universe where in order to prevent Trump's possible FBI director, who was so bad that when he was offered up in the first term for the number two job at FBI, Bill Barr said that I would resign, you know, rather than let him become that.
But keep in mind, Bill Barr is part of the deep state conspiracy. He's on that list.
Absolutely. He showed his hand. You know, he let everybody know. But, you know, in order to prevent Cash Patel from doing something egregious, then, you know, Joe Biden is being pushed now by people, including Bernie Sanders, you know, or who are suggesting that you just do a blanket pardon of people who haven't been charged with anything, but, you know, might be under Trump.
I think that would be a huge mistake to do that. That plays into Republicans' hands. That's evidence that these people actually were guilty of crimes. Then they never have to actually try to prove that. We can just assume that, you know, if they did nothing wrong, why would they need pardons? So I think that would be a big mistake. At least one of those people, is it Sarah Isker? Is that her name? Who used to work, in the Trump administration. She said, I will not accept one if it's offered. And for that reason, that legitimizes these claims that we committed crimes when in fact we didn't.
Is a blanket preemptive pardon of everybody. Let's start over.
Yeah.
Jubilee justice.
Well, if I may just...
No, you may not, actually, because we're late.
Okay.
We need to get to our...
we're having a conversation.
Listener email of the week. You can maybe have it on the podcast that has your name on it. Let's get to our listener email of the week. Although first, a word from our sponsors who do the middle of the podcast, Nick, from the University of Chicago. Friends, in an election year, it's too easy to get lost in the fog of news and opinion. Understanding the real life impact of political events can be a challenge in these even numbered years. So we have got a podcast we would like to recommend. It's called Not Another Politics Podcast, brought to you by the University of Chicago's Harris School of Public Policy. Not Another Politics Podcast provides clear, research-driven perspectives on the biggest issues of the day. Get the insights you need to truly understand the political landscape. No spin, just facts. Subscribe today at harris.uchicago.edu/NAPP. That's harris.uchicago.edu/NAPP. Or just look for Not Another Politics Podcast wherever you find such things. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. All right. Reminder, please email your brief queries to roundtable@reason.com. This one comes from Brenner Roth, who writes in part, I am personally for involuntary commitments to mental institutions in extreme situations. Obviously, this system would be ripe for abuse and should be monitored and regulated. But the opposite side of the issue is that insane people walk around the streets causing daily havoc. So my question is, would Jordan Neely be alive if he was involuntarily committed to a mental institution? I am personally in favor of Daniel Penny being acquitted, since this violent altercation was an output of the system in New York City of ignoring these issues, and then individuals get caught in the crossfire. This also seems to have made prisons the pipeline for mentally unstable persons, so we seem to jail a lot of these people one way or the other eventually. Nick, you are a mentally unstable person walking through the streets of New York City.
The subway, yeah.
And you take the subway. But as someone who lives in New York City,
Jackson impersonator.
What do you say about involuntary commitments to people who are obviously jabbering lunatics who seem they might be threatening?
Yeah, this, I think it's a great question. And I'm really curious to see how in the four squares that are showing up on the stream, I think the lower half, I think I know they're going to be different than the upper half. Although, Matt, I won't pretend to speak for you. There's a law in place where, you know, you put somebody away for a very limited period of time if they are a harm to themselves or others. And I know people who have gone through this process, and it is used, it can be abused. And in the past, the history of psychiatric hospitals in America is in very large part this type of power, which was broader in the past than it is now, being abused to kind of get rid of people who are problematic to their families or to their employers or to society in general and things like that. But I think that a wisely used and a strictly scrutinized use of things like the 5150 laws in California are helpful. And that, you know, when you think about somebody like Jordan Neely, it's hard to say would he be alive otherwise. I mean, it's not the system that failed him as much as he was on a train car with Daniel Penny. That's really the difference in that particular case. But this is a guy who was in and out of institutions, in and out of surveillance and the police state, the carceral state, and it didn't work. So the system as it is doesn't work very well, but on the more, or certainly didn't in his case. But in that case of involuntary lockup for people who are showing a threat to themselves or people around them, I think we have a basic, the idea of a system, to paraphrase Donald Trump, that actually makes sense. And then the question is, how do you build out on that so that people who are mentally ill and are in a state of mania or duress or whatever, where they are temporarily not capable of making rational decisions, how do you get them to a point where they can be like that?
Jacob, you've covered this a time or two in your life. What say you to the emails question?
There's not a satisfactory answer, but we should not understate the problems with abusing what is an unprovable hypothesis about any given person. He's behaving in a bizarre way that people find disturbing, and we surmise that something's wrong with his brain, that he has some kind of psychiatric condition, that he meets criteria that are laid out in a book, and therefore he's going to be eligible to be locked up, not for any crime that he's actually committed, but possibly for crimes that we are afraid he might commit in the future. So it's a kind of preventive detention, but based on criteria that really have very little scientific validity to them. So that's tremendously dangerous to civil liberties for, I think, obvious reasons. At the same time, I lived in New York City. It's not fun, especially if you have little kids, to be encountering these people on the subway or the streets. And I asked Thomas Szasz about this. What do you do with such people who are shouting or, angrily gesticulating and shouting and seem like they could be threatening? And his response was, if they commit a crime, then they should go to jail. Otherwise, not. And there are certain crimes that don't require actual violence, that are things like menacing, harassment, or whatever that people can be charged with. But then you the other side will say, now you're putting people in prison who actually belong in a hospital where they can get treatment. But again, it's in a hospital for a condition that is not objectively verifiable with treatments that mostly make people more manageable, don't actually cure a purported disease. No solution is satisfactory, as I said, but there's a tremendous danger to liberty if you're going to say that people who behave in odd and disturbing ways, we should lock them up.
Catherine, how do you split this hair?
I am, as Nick guessed, more on the Solomian, Szaszian end of the spectrum, if that is an end of a spectrum. Listen, ultimately, a lot of what is happening here is that we are putting people in, we are depriving them of their liberty. We are locking them up. And the distinction between mental hospital and jail, I think, is secondary here for the sin of not having, as Mike Riggs put it in the debate that we ran on this topic, curtains to hide their faults. And so I think at least part of the answer here is like the thing that people are objecting to in most of these cases, in many of these cases, is the public nature of the mental illness. And that is something that is subject to solutions that don't violate people's liberty, we can make it easier to build. We can make it easier to create voluntary and kind of community systems that support those people. But I think that it's just like it is not a hypothetical that this power of involuntary commitment and especially indefinite voluntary commitment can be abused. In the 70s, state mental hospitals had three times as many people as are currently in federal prison when the population was 60% of what it is now. That is just a massive, massive, massive infringement on people's liberty. And in many of those cases, they were people who, as Jacob said, perhaps hypothetically might commit a crime or do antisocial behavior and had not, in fact, done anything wrong. I just think we are in a little moment where even many of our libertarian friends are feeling kind of law and ordery about some of this stuff. And I think it is very, very important to keep in mind why we opposed that when things seemed more peaceful, because those reasons still apply.
I would commend people to read, just on a factual basis, regardless of what you think of his argument, a piece that Josh Barrow wrote on his Substack over the past week or two about the case, drawing from reporting in New York Magazine that really drilled down into Jordan Neely's life. Couple of details that are of interest to the conversation. One is that he actually got pretty good care at Rikers. This is not what we generally expect to ever happen, but that that they put him on meds. I guess he's schizophrenic. I'm not exactly sure of the thing, but they put him on meds and they described him as being kind of a model prisoner. Usually people have a real bad time there because it's Rikers, but that he was friendly. He was engaged. He was like involved with his own kind of sense of recovery and mental health. All the sweet things that you've heard about the guy in other contexts were coming out there. And then when he eventually left, he was diverted to a mental institution to exchange for like so that he wouldn't have to serve at Rikers for assault. Right. The condition was like, OK, you got to go there, check into this mental institution and we won't put you in jail because, you know, he's assaulting people, including, I think, a 67-year-old woman. Not great. So he went to the mental institution, but then they kept the door unlocked and he walked out. And so at the time of the incidents that ended his life, he was wanted. On warrants for having escaped this, but they didn't put a lock on the door. So in Josh Barrow's argument, you should put a lock on the door in that case, and then something might be better. I don't know if I necessarily agree with that, but it's kind of interesting that at least for a moment, he seemed to have, and I'm sure Thomas Soz would love this, have medicated his situation so that that he was improving. And we haven't figured out a way, I don't think, really, to deal in crowded circumstances with people who are menacing others in public. I think that there's the argument that I've made that makes Catherine mad is that I think that there can be a sort of public intoxication standard. Like if you are just behaving so erratically that it seems as if you are menacing people, I think that it doesn't necessarily mean we'd lock you up and throw away the key of anything, but we can take you out of that situation, or the local law enforcement can just physically remove you at that moment and go talk to you over in a corner. I think that is a reasonable standard to have, but I understand that good people could disagree.
I mean, I think it's important to stress that, you know, the rules on mandatory or involuntary commitment, which, you know, if somebody's picked up on the street, it's not like they're getting sent away, you know, to Willowbrook or Creedmoor or, you know, one of these horrifying snake pits of the past for their life. It's for a short period of time. And it's not simply odd because they're acting odd and disturbing. It's because they are articulating or they represent a clear threat to themselves or the public or other people around them. And that helps to limit this type of stuff. It's also true. I mean, I think, you know, within, I'm very Sozian. I feel like Soz and Foucault, Irving Goffman and R.D. Lang, all of whom articulated a very overlapping, you know, distinct but in the same direction critique of the medicalization of society and the psychiatric state and how that gets used as cover for all kinds of coercive behavior. You know, we also have to update some of that with, you know, the ways in which modern antipsychotic drugs work and other types of things help people to manage their demons, whether, you know, whether you believe they're demons or blood chemical imbalances and things like that. You don't have a right to necessarily, and I don't think that Jordan Neely should have died. And unfortunately, if he had been on like the next car down, probably he would still be out there on the streets, and Daniel Penny would never, you know, have gone to see a foot, you know, the Army Navy game with J.D. Vance and Donald Trump, and we wouldn't be talking about this in this particular instance. But he was saying to people in a menacing way, "I don't mind going to jail and getting life in prison. I'm ready to die." I don't know that you just say, "Okay, well, the proper, you know, the proper response to that is to, you know, get off and move to the next subway car."
Right. All right, let's get to our end of podcast, what we've all been consuming in the cultural arena. Catherine, why don't you lead us off?
Sure. I am reading the new Haruki Murakami book, The City and Its Uncertain Walls. I will be doing a little mini review of it in the next issue of the magazine, but it is a Haruki Murakami book. And so if you like those, you should read this one. It doesn't feel like anything particularly new for him, but I, for one, am utterly delighted to sink back into the very, very kind of beautiful, delicate, dreamlike world where you just hang out in a library and try to figure out whether your real self and your shadow self are the same person or two people, and which one is the real you. Like, that's all. That's the kind of book that you can do. I do think, as is suggested by the title, there is like some kind of metaphorical use to be had here of the idea of the city and the self, and sort of where you are is who you are. And so it strikes me that it's relevant for our immigration debate, although only in the most lightly beautiful and poetic and metaphorical way. So, The City and Its Uncertain Walls, Haruki Murakami, for people who already like Haruki Murakami.
Nick, what did you consume?
I watched Will and Harper, which is a documentary featuring Will Ferrell and Harper Steele, who's formerly Andrew Steele, and served as the Saturday Night Live's head writer while Ferrell was on the show. And then he also co-wrote a couple of Ferrell movies, including the bizarre one Casa de Mi Padre, where Will Ferrell plays a Mexican aristocrat or land baron. It's a very odd and funny movie. And more recently, the Eurovision Song Contest, the story of Fire Saga. So during the pandemic, then Andrew Steele starts transitioning to Harper, and he gets in touch with Ferrell, who he was close with, and they end up going on a road trip from New York to California. And it is on a certain level, and I think there's going to be a lot of products like this where it's almost like they are light, you know, light emanating from the dying planet that was the kind of, peak of woke America. Where people, there were things still in the pipeline that are coming from a world that seemed to have ended with the election of Donald Trump for the second time and everybody proclaiming the end of woke. What's really good about this movie is that, first off, Harper Steele transitions in middle age. And it is this, it's a beautiful, nuanced, weird and very at times ugly story of transition in middle age, and it's a beautiful road movie. They go through America, and they go, you know, they eat like a 72-ounce steak in Amarillo. They go to the types of haunts that as Andrew Harper would like to drive around the country. He's originally from Iowa and would just stop in small towns and go to dive bars. And then once transitioned, she doesn't feel comfortable doing that. And so they try that out a couple of times. And it's just, her family is involved. It's just one of the best things that I've seen in a long time, because it gets away from the stark ideological battles where at the beginning of maybe of this process, when South Park was, you know, making fun of the way that everybody had to say that Caitlyn Jenner, was brave and, outstanding or whatever. We went from, you know, being able to kind of have a discussion about this to things real, people moving to the furthest corners possible and either saying, like, you are a pedophile and a child abuser if you believe in transsexual, you know, ideology or whatever we're calling it, to you can only lionize it. This is a great beginning to start rehumanizing that conversation and bringing it back down to, you know, the human level.
Very good. Jacob Sullivan, what did you consume?
There is a really interesting documentary on Hulu about the Stanford Prison Experiment, which anybody who's taken Psych 101 probably read about that. The way that Phil Zimbardo, the psychologist who put this together, has presented over the years, is quite misleading in several important respects. The documentary is sort of a roller coaster because initially you're like, oh my God, Phil Zimbardo is totally full of shit. And then, like, everything they ever said about this experiment was a lie because it's very heavy on criticism at the beginning. He gets his own licks in responding to the critics. Then ultimately, I don't want to, I guess this is a spoiler alert, not really. I mean, he's dead now, but he was alive at the time that they made it. And they go back to him with very specific questions. And he was like, I've already responded to this criticism. So now the edge really goes to his critics by the end of it. But it's just a very interesting exploration of what did this thing mean? They took a bunch of students. They said, you're the guards. You're the prisoners. Go. And I think the best way to think about it, as I think somebody in the documentary suggests, is that this is improv. This is like a improv for a week or two. And certainly some of the people who were guards, one guy in particular who was like the meanest, nastiest guard, presented it that way, that he was just playing a role. But of course, he could be rationalizing his own egregious behavior by presenting it that way, which is the way what Zimbardo says. But a bunch of these subjects, they follow up with them, you know, many years later, have really bad feelings towards Zimbardo, that they felt like they were misled, that he didn't describe his methodology accurately. In particular, there's a dispute about the extent to which he pushed them to be mean, as opposed to simply saying, you're the guards and you're the prisoners. There's a recording of a briefing that he gave them before the experiment started, where he does seem to be suggesting that they should be punitive. They couldn't actually be violent, like they couldn't, you know, physically abuse the prisoners. I think probably the way it was presented is that ordinary, decent people, given when they're assigned roles, even if they're fake roles basically a kind of improv, they do things they later are ashamed of, whatever. And then when the whole Abu Ghraib scandal came out, Zimbardo was on TV all over the place. He was a huge publicity hound. That's very clear from this documentary. But he was very glibly saying, see, I showed you why this sort of thing happens. Why? Now, in the case of the prison experiment, nothing like what happened at Abu Ghraib happened. And supposedly it was all voluntary. People could get out anytime they wanted to. So I think that's one of the strongest criticisms is that it's very glib to say, this is all because of what I showed you with the Stanford Prison Experiment, because it was very, the two situations were very dissimilar in important ways. But it's worth grappling with because Zimbardo felt like he was unfairly maligned and he has sort of rational responses, but not completely satisfying ones to the criticism. The critics think they've completely demolished this study in terms of what it shows, you know, about people generally. But, you know, you can make the call for yourself if you watch it on Hulu.
You know, I've seen that and I find it fascinating because, Jacob, you were a psych undergrad, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, as was I. And, you know, between that experiment, the David Rosenhan's on being sane in insane places, and the Stanley Milgram, the shock experiments, and particularly, these are like three massively epic, like long tail studies that all have kind of dissolved upon closer inspection, because it turns out that, you know, the guys running them faked a lot of the data or left out data or simplified things or changed their stories about stuff. They were run really poorly. I mean, in a way, they anticipate the replication crisis that continues to bedevil social psychology. And I think the prison experiment itself is fascinating. And then, like, you know, when Zimbardo came back, you know, during Abu Ghraib, I was like, oh, wow, that's really interesting. And I went back and looked at all of the new research and it was like, fuck, it really, you know, what happened in Abu Ghraib is terrible, but it's not clear that he's the guy we should be talking to figure any of that out.
Very good. I read a book called Revolution on the Hudson, holding it up for the viewers at home, by George Don. It's about the Revolutionary War theater of the Hudson River and the sort of waterworks that go up through Lake Champlain and St. Lawrence River, and how King George really thought that was the key. If we get this supreme British Navy to have full control over that waterway, you can cut off the annoying people in Boston and win the war, and never really could do that, and never stopped being fixated on it. And George Washington as well was also kind of fixated on that, just in terms of defense. It's a very workmanlike history by a historian who's also, I think, done a book about the 1812 war. And of interest, I haven't actually read all that much about the Revolutionary War and have been looking into it lately and having fun. A couple of takeaways that are that I found of interest were just a reminder of how many times the war hung in the balance. Like if this would have happened this way, it could have all been different, which it starts with very close to where I'm talking from, like at the very beginning of the war in August. There was a Dunkirk-like evacuation of Brooklyn Heights after the First Battle of Brooklyn, in which the Brits and the Hessians could have just kind of cleaned it all up, and they didn't. The Washington snuck across the East River, and a couple of series like that, including on the other way. Like, Americans had a couple of chances to end the war. Benedict Arnold, if it would have gone this way instead of that way, could have changed things. Very interesting, just in that history is more contingent than we type of think that we generally think of. And then the other bit is just how much the Brits didn't understand that you can't win the hearts and minds of people when you are raping them all the time. sorry, that's not very funny. But they went into places like especially Staten Island, New Jersey. I don't know why those two places had so many loyalists to the crown, but they did. And they sort of just assumed that they would have all of those people be really excited to fight for the Redcoats, but they really treated those local inhabitants like human garbage, just pillaged them, acted awfully, and also used terror as an outright weapon on a lot of different villages, committed atrocities. And so they weren't ever able to get any serious fighting force on their side. In fact, they provoked a ton of opposition, and especially along kind of Hudson Valley area. And that's what turned the Battle of Saratoga, which was a decisive point, was a whole bunch of people, militiamen, came out of nowhere and just said, screw you guys for acting like such atrocious dirtbags. And I think there's some lessons there to be had in the world. So Revolution on the Hudson by George C. Don. Good book. Liked it. All right. That's all the time we have to recommend Revolutionary War books on this podcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks again for the Webathon donations. You can still donate to us any old time at reason.com/donate. Look at all of our great podcasts, including the impeccable Reason interview with Dr. Nick Gillespie. At reason.com/podcasts. Events we still have. Nick and I are going to be on the Reason side of the Reason versus debate this Wednesday, December 18th, in Washington, D.C., against the Bulwarks, Tim Miller and Sarah Longwell. We will be debating the proposition on whether one must or must not take sides in politics.
By the way, Matt, I've switched sides. I'm now with them.
I wouldn't blame you for even a half a second.
Yeah.
But tickets are still available. Go to reason.com/events. Nick, is there anything? No, there's nothing going on here until January. So enough of your loose talk. Say goodbye to Nick, actually. He's going to be taking a much-deserved vacation and seeing some very interesting places. I'm not going to disclose.
It's called involuntary commitment.
I thought it was voluntary. Oh, it changes
everything.
Doesn't feel
that way. Yeah. Doesn't feel that way.
It's Very good. All right. Thanks again. And thanks to Jacob Solomon. Solomon? Why not? Jacob Suleiman did a fantastic job, as always. And I hope he comes back soon to replace me. Bye. What's your